What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. This episode, I speak with Jim DeFede. Jim is a journalist and author who, in 2002, published an oral history called The Day the World Came to Town. It's an oral history of the small town of Gander, Newfoundland, and Labrador, Canada, in the wake of the September 11th attacks. It's a story of humanity and of generosity, and it's a story that's endured. And it was a pleasure to speak with him about this event that is known to some and should be known to many more. And now I give you Jim DeFede. Okay, I'm here with Jim DeFede. Jim, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, my pleasure. So jumping right into it, the story of Gander, Newfoundland, and its, let's call it, intersection with 9/11 is something that's fascinated me for a long time. Plenty of people know about the intersection, but many people don't. And to the extent that they do know about it, they would have to have you to thank for it, Jim. So we'll get there in a minute, but before we do, please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name is Jim DeFede. I'm a reporter. I've been a reporter for more than 30 years. I started with daily newspapers in Spokane, Washington, and then came to Miami back in 91. I've worked for weeklies. I've worked for national magazines. I'm currently a reporter at the CBS station in Miami. So I've done a little bit of everything.
Excellent. Excellent. So yes, getting right into it then, you penned the oral history, The Day the World Came to Town, back in 2002. And it was, in fact, just re-released, I believe, late last year. And it's now a Broadway play, in fact. For any of our listeners unfamiliar with the story, Jim, can you please run through what happened in Gander and why?
Sure. No, absolutely. I love telling this story because it's, you know, when we think about September 11th, there's not a lot of good that obviously occurred that day. But this is an example where humanity prevailed. So on that day, on September 11th, 2001, obviously after the planes were flown into the towers, into the Pentagon, after the plane crashed in the field in Pennsylvania, the U.S. had to make a decision that it had never made in the history of aviation. It shut down all airspace over the United States. They were worried that other planes may be used as weapons. And so they ordered every plane in the air to immediately land. And when I say to immediately land, I don't mean that, you know, if you were on a flight from L.A. to Miami, you continued and landed in Miami. If you were on a plane from L.A. to Miami and you were over Dallas at the moment that the order was given, you immediately had to land at the Dallas airport. And that, as I said, that had never been done before. And let's start by thanking the air traffic controllers on duty that day, because they did a phenomenal job, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, airports all over the country were being told, you're now getting these planes, and all of these planes have to land, from jumbo jetliners to small private planes. Everything had to go down. I've actually seen, you know, videotape of the airspace over the United States, and it actually looks like little circular funnels, like from your drain when water backs up. Overall, every major city in the United States are just planes landing, coming down, landing, landing, landing. Well, if you were on a flight from Europe to the United States, you obviously couldn't land in the Atlantic. You didn't know what was really going on. And a lot of pilots were unaware of what was happening. Some pilots made the decision to turn around and head back to Europe. But other pilots just assumed that there was some emergency in New York. But if they were a flight, for instance, from Frankfurt to L.A., you would just assume you would be routed around whatever the problem was eventually, and that as a result, you would be able to continue on. So even though airspace was quote-unquote shut down in the United States, they figured that over the course of the 3, 4, 5 hours that they were making the transatlantic trip, they would get sorted out and they would be able to still make their destination. So a lot of planes continued on towards the United States. Well, you know, obviously the United States was not allowing any planes, especially from Europe, to enter U.S. airspace. In fact, they were being told that any plane that attempted to enter U.S. airspace would be shot down. So these airlines then had an issue. Now, what do you do? Many of them had passed sort of the point of no return, meaning they couldn't turn around any longer by the time they realized the seriousness of it. And so they had to go somewhere. And Canada stepped forward. Canada made the decision to allow all of the planes that were headed from Europe and on the east side, of course, on the west side, any planes coming in from Asia to land on the west coast of Canada. But it can't be understated as well what the Canadians did here, because the U.S. believed that there were threats on these planes, that there were people and individuals who could be on these planes who were waiting to get closer to the United States, where they would then jump into action, hijack a plane, crash it themselves. The Canadian officials knew that those planes had potential terrorists on board there. But I spoke to the Canadian Prime Minister at the time, Jean Chrétien, and he said there was no choice but to, of course, allow these passengers for their own safety to land in Canada. They never hesitated to give safe harbor to all of those planes. And that takes us to Gander. Now, of course, many of these planes landed in major cities like Toronto and Montreal and Halifax, but there were 38 jetliners that landed in the small town of Gander, Newfoundland. Gander being a town of less than 10,000 people, taking in 38 jetliners with about 7,000 passengers. So a town of 10,000 people suddenly absorbed, in a matter of hours, 7,000 passengers. The town literally doubled overnight. And my book, The Day the World Came to Town, tells the story of the 5 days that those passengers spent in Gander, because airspace, if you recall, did not immediately open up. There was a lot of confusion in the United States in the days after 9/11. And so these planes were stuck on the ground, the passengers were taken off the planes, and the townspeople there in Gander and the surrounding towns of Appleton and Gambo came together and cared for the passengers, took care of them, literally opened up their homes to them, to the point where obviously you use the local schools, you use the churches, you use the Moose Lodge, the Elks Lodge. When those things filled up, people just opened up their homes and said, I can take 5 passengers at my house. They actually called them the plane people, plane, P-L-A-N-E. They said, I can take 5 of the plane people in my house. I can have 6 of the plane people come over and stay with me. Or they started forming brigades where any passenger who was at the school, and if they needed a place to go and shower, have them come by my house. I'll leave the door open. They could just go in, shower, we'll put out towels. It is an amazing story of just a community coming together. And in many ways, Gander was unique in that regard. Gander was probably the best place possible for these passengers. And I'm sure we can get into more as to why that's the case. But in an overall sense, this is the story of what happened in Gander and those 5 days where passengers were stuck there and needing to be cared for and tended to, and how the town rose up to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Jim. Yeah, it's the spirit of generosity in which it was shown, and that struck me first. And let me just sharpen one of the points there, just in case it blew past our audience a little too quickly. The Canadian government, as I understand it, did not have to take these planes. They could have said no, correct?
Yeah, that is absolutely right. Matter of fact, there were officials in the government who said, why should we take the risk? You know, that maybe they would see if they can turn around and make it back to Europe. They could go to Ireland and land there. But again, as I said, you know, the Canadian officials understood that if there was a threat on these planes, better to get them down quickly. And the funny thing is the pilots really didn't understand the threat until they really got close to the United States. They heard the radio traffic about planes crashing. They assumed it was a small plane in the towers, and they started hearing about terrorism. It was a little garbled. They were waiting for instructions from their home offices, from their headquarters as to what to do on their telex machines. But one of the things that the pilots did in almost every case was they never told the passengers. They didn't want the passengers to know because for several reasons. One, they didn't want to panic passengers. Second, if there were potential terrorist threats on board the planes, they didn't want to give them a heads up that things were happening, things were moving, because they were afraid that might ignite them. So again, we keep thinking of things in terms of post 9/11. Remember pre 9/11, most doors to cockpits were never locked. They were usually, the door was usually open. I mean, right. How many times did you fly back then, you know, where you would be able to look in and see the pilot, you know, sure. Or the pilot or some kid would say, hey, I can't, you know, like, oh, Johnny, come on up. I'll take you up to the cockpit and show you around and show you that. There was no secure bars on doors. There were no major locks the way they used to. So some of the pilots ended up doing things like barricading themselves in their own cockpits for fear of that. And they didn't even notify passengers that they were landing in Canada until literally they were making the approach to land in Canada. this was going to catch everyone by surprise for the most part. Now, some folks had their cell phones with them or were getting updates, especially once they landed. But for the most part, the passengers suddenly looked out the window or suddenly realized that, you know, a flight that was supposed to take 7 hours was now suddenly there were a lot less because they were landing in Newfoundland. And most of them had to look on the map as to where Newfoundland was because they had never heard of it before.
No, excellent. So then when and how did you first become aware of the story, Jim?
So I give all credit to this to the publisher of my book, Judith Regan, for Regan Books, an imprint of HarperCollins. I had been working on a different book that sort of fell apart. I'll just say it that way. And Judith had a meeting with me and said, you know, there's a story that I read a small newspaper clipping about. And I think there's something really unique and special in this. And this was in December of 2001, in December. So just about a month after 9/11. And she said, why don't you start making some calls and checking into this? And let's see if maybe there's an opportunity here to do something, to tell a story. And I did. I started making some calls. I called the mayor of Gander. I did a little bit more research, reached out to a few other people. And when I started hearing the story, I was more and more intrigued. And so we agreed that it was worth a trip up there. And so I ended up arranging a trip up to Gander in February of 2002. And I stayed there for about 6 weeks, just interviewing people, driving around town, getting a sense of things. And then put the book together, and it came out on the first anniversary. So in September or August of September of 2002, it was very quick, but it was one of those books that really sort of came together quickly because it was a story everyone in Gander wanted to talk about. Obviously, there was this amazing event that had occurred there. Everyone had a story to tell. It wasn't like I had to do a lot of deep diving research.
Right.
You know, wherever I stayed, wherever I went, whoever I talked to had their own story to tell about the plane people. Oh, yeah, some of them stayed with me, or, oh, yeah, we had a bunch of them here, or they used to hang out at the bar over there. So, yeah, everyone knew somebody. And that's how, and just sort of talking to people, interviewing them, then of course, the trick I thought of to myself was, well, how am I going to reach the passengers? I mean, my goodness, they're all gone. They're spread all over the world. And I'm an idiot because I started thinking to myself, well, I guess I could get there and maybe I can find a way to convince the airport manager to maybe give me some flight manifests from back in the day. And geez, I don't know how I'm going to do that, but I'll try to figure that out. And then once I got there, of course, if somebody stayed in your house for 4 or 5 days, you have their name. They probably gave you their phone number. You know, hey, yeah, let's keep in touch. So once I started meeting people in Gander, I then was, they put me in touch with the people they had formed close bonds to. And that's how I was doing all my reporting, was basically just talking to people. And that would lead me to somebody else and somebody else and somebody else. I mean, you know, my book focuses on maybe 30 characters. You could have written a book with 6,000 characters because every person who came through there had a story to tell. Every person in town, all 10,000 people in town had stories to tell. You could have, I mean, I could still be writing a story every day and I still wouldn't have finished it now 20 years later.
Amazing. I love it. You know, you were on the verge of answering one of my questions a minute ago there, Jim. With a show like Eyewitness History, as you might imagine, one of my goals, I feel, as host is to put the listeners there with you, you know, as you're describing it. So I'll ask the question just directly. So you arrive in Gander. What is the first thing you do? What did you observe as you arrived?
All right. So I live in Miami, Florida. So again, and I said before, I decided to go to Gander in February. This is not the ideal time to go to Newfoundland. It is cold. It is, you know, not the most hospitable place in the winter. Winters are kind of tough there. So I leave Miami. I fly. Let me see if I can remember this correctly.
Yeah.
I fly Miami to Toronto, Toronto to Halifax, Halifax to Stevensville, Stevensville to Gander. Every plane gets progressively smaller.
Oh, no.
You know, I leave Miami, it's in the 90s. I get to Gander, it's like minus 10. So I've gone like 100 degrees full cycle. When you get to that last plane, Stevensville to Gander, that's one of those planes where they ask you how much you weigh when you check in, because they got to figure out the weight distribution on the plane. As you may tell, I'm not a small person. And, you know, there were several people standing behind me online to get on this plane to check in. And I remember when the person at the counter asked me how much I weighed, I sort of looked nervously around and I looked at the people behind me, and the people behind me had this look on their face like, don't lie. You better tell them the truth. We're not dying because you're too proud to tell them how fat you are. Tell them. So I mumbled something, and then the guy said, what? I said, and he said, all right. And then I think they threw some stuff off the plane and got us all in. And then so I land in Gander, and it must have been like 2 a.m. It is deadly cold. And just so you know, before leaving, I had made reservations at a hotel, but it was like a long-term stay hotel where you could book a room for a month. And I was talking to the manager, and she was a very nice woman. And I said, I'm coming from Miami. I haven't really lived in cold climates in a long time. I had to go out and buy a parka because I didn't own one. And I just sort of said, how bad is the winter? And she said, oh, it's not so bad. We can still see the truck tops. And I went, I have no idea what that means. And then she explained, okay, I understand. Well, the hotel is right on the TCH, the Trans-Canada Highway. And as the winter progresses and the snow falls, the plows come along the highway and pile the snow up on the side of the road. And, you know, after the first month or so of snows, you can't see cars anymore, but you can still see the tops of trucks. We know it's a really bad winter when the piles on the side of the road are so high, we can't see the 18-wheelers anymore. But it's okay. We can still see the tops of the trucks, so it's not so bad. And I went, oh, that's reassuring. So I get to Gander, and I get off the plane with my other passengers who seem very relieved that we made it. And I go it's one of those planes where you walk down the steps and walk into the airport, and it's a small airport. And there's the woman at the rental car just standing there. And I'm thinking, how much business are they doing that the rental car? I mean, I had a rental car, and she said, Mr. Defeedy? And I said, yes. And she said, I've been waiting for you. I said, have you been waiting all night? She said, no. I went home, had dinner, went to bed, set my alarm for 1:30. And then got out of bed and drove over here's your keys to your car. And I went, it's parked out front. And okay. And when she said it's parked out front, I mean, like as you go leave the airport, those sliding double doors, my car was on the curb in front of the sliding double doors to the point where people leaving had to walk around the car because they couldn't get, because and the motor was running, the windows had been scraped of ice, it was already heated, and just running, just a car just running, nobody attending to it, just running. And I get in and I, you know, drive off and I find my hotel. But that tells you about Gander. Nobody's afraid of anybody stealing a car. You know, they park the car on the sidewalk in front of the thing. And they go, oh, your car's right out front. Where? Oh, right out front. So that's how I got to Gander. Now, Gander, let me just sort of explain to you a little bit about Gander and Newfoundland. Let's start with Newfoundland.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Newfoundland is the easternmost province of Canada, Newfoundland and Labrador. And Newfoundland is the poorest province in Canada. Highest unemployment rate, decimated by a lot of issues have contributed to problems in Newfoundland. Gander is in the center of Newfoundland on a flat section of land. It's not on the coast. It's not in the pretty part. Like there's St. John and the very pretty and all the little coastal communities, very pretty. This is a section of just flat land. And the reason why is that Gander was created specifically to become an airport. And it was initially created as a joint project between the Canadian government, the U.S. government, and the British government. Newfoundland was sort of an ambiguous territory. That was not formally part of Canada. It sort of had its own sort of connections to England and to Canada, but it wasn't really a province. And in the 1930s, anticipating World War II and the buildup to World War II, they built massive airstrips in this town. Well, there was no town. They just built. They basically built an Army Air Force base there, jointly operated by the Canadians, the Brits, and the United States. They all went in on it, knowing probably what was coming in the, you know, later that decade and into the 40s.
Right.
So the idea being is that any plane that needed to get from the United States to Europe, United States to England, had to refuel at this airstrip. And around the airstrip and around the military base grew the town of Gander. So that's the only reason it was there, was for the airbase. And so the idea was that, especially as you got to World War II, Gander was the busiest airport in the world. When I say that, I mean that a plane was either landing or taking off every 2 minutes from that airport, round the clock. Troop transports, cargo planes, everything that the United States needed to ship and get over to Europe during World War II passed through Gander. It either went by boat or it went by plane. And so everything moved through Gander. You would stop there, refuel, get on, move on, the war effort. It was a frequent subject. The waters around Newfoundland patrolled by Nazi U-boats all the time, looking for ships coming in and out. This was a place that was critical to U.S. and Canada and keeping England alive during those early days of the war. That's how we maintained our presence in World War II, was through Gander. Now, after World War II, you sort of, you know, still needed an airport like that because you now had international travel. People, Pan Am, other airlines were now flying, TWA, were flying to Europe. Again, you still needed to refuel. Planes weren't equipped. Propeller planes weren't really able to make the transatlantic crossing without stopping to refuel. So they would stop in Gander. That's where everyone went and stopped. You stopped in Gander, then you flew on to Europe, wherever your destination was. So Gander played a great role in the 50s still and into the 60s. But with the advent of the jet engine, you suddenly didn't need that anymore. There was no need to refuel in Gander. The only people who started continued to refuel in Gander were smaller private planes. Oprah Winfrey probably has spent more time in Gander than most people alive, because when she would fly to Europe, her Gulfstream would stop in Gander for refueling. There's lots of pictures in the Gander airport of Oprah Winfrey just sort of being in town. And so the other thing that's remarkable about it during this time, I'm going off on a little tangent, but it's totally fine. This understanding of history.
Yeah.
This was the key place where, when the Cold War took place, Gander also played a pivotal role. So during the Cold War, if you were flying, let's say, from the Soviet Union to Havana, you couldn't stop in New York to refuel. You weren't stopping there. Same thing from the other way. If you were flying from Havana to Moscow, you stop in Gander to refuel. In fact, the only other person who probably spent more time in Gander than Oprah Winfrey was Fidel Castro. Because every time Fidel Castro would fly to the Soviet Union or to East Germany or anywhere in the Eastern Bloc, he would stop in Gander. And the mayor used to tell me stories going into the 80s and 90s where Fidel Castro's plane would land. There would be a diplomatic security from the Canadian government would stop by. And then Fidel would get off the plane, go into a private hangar and have lunch while the plane was being refueled. And usually the mayor would tell me, I would sit with him. I would sit there and Fidel would speak for about 2 hours during lunch through a translator. I would just sit there and nod and nod and nod. And then one of his security people would tell him it was time to go, and he would take a picture with them and get on the plane and fly off. Well, but now imagine this. Now imagine you're in East Germany before the fall of the Berlin Wall. They used to say the fastest way to get from East Germany to West Germany was through Gander. So if you were in East Germany and you were able to afford and way to get out, you would be able to get a visa to go enjoy yourself in Havana. Very popular spot, warm, beautiful beaches of Havana. So plane loads of people from East Germany would fly, stop in Gander to refuel, and as soon as the plane touched down, half the passengers on the plane would get off the plane and defect. And they had actually set up a station in Gander that would process the individuals. They would then spend about, I don't know, a day in Gander, and then they would get on another plane to West Germany. So, and then they would be reunited with family there. And so that's how that was one of the most popular ways of defecting from East Germany to West Germany, was arranging a vacation to Cuba, stopping in Gander, getting off, seeking political asylum. They were waiting for you. Everyone got off, they fill out the paperwork, and then they load you on a plane and send you right back to West Germany. So this place is just, this is a unique thing. And I say this only but in way of saying this. For many, many decades, Gander had a purpose. Gander served throughout World War II, during the advent of the cross-Atlantic, transatlantic early days of air travel. It played a pivotal role during the Cold War. But after the Berlin Wall fell, after Soviet Union collapsed, Gander really lost its place. Gander didn't really serve a function anymore. There was no need. Even private planes could fly to Europe without having to stop to refuel. And so the only real reason that Gander remained in existence, the town's population shrank, the military base became almost non-existent, the businesses in the community struggled to survive because what was once a thriving town with lots of activity, people coming in and out, had dwindled to almost a ghost town status. So it was down to like 10,000 people. occasionally, they would get the random plane with a medical emergency. So if you were flying from Europe to the United States and somebody on your plane had a heart attack, they either landed in Ireland or they landed in Newfoundland, depending on where you were closest. Because that was the first piece of land. Once you get past Ireland, then the next time that you're close to land is Newfoundland. And so you would land in Newfoundland and they would come and take you to the hospital and treat you there. And then the plane would take off. Other than that, the town had lost its identity. Well, along comes 9/11. And all of these planes flying across the Atlantic need a place to go. And these are big planes. And sure enough, what do they remember? They remember the little town that had lost its way, that still had those incredibly long runways that were built for bombers and heavy cargo planes during World War II. So they had those super long runways. And suddenly, the town that had no real purpose or meaning found purpose and meaning again on 9/11. So that was something else that the town came together about. They saw this as an opportunity to revive, the history of their own town. Because so much of Gander is that spirit of helping neighbors, coming together, helping one another. And they had sort of lost that because there was no need for that anymore. Now they needed it. And that's why 9/11 was so important for them. They couldn't screw it up. They weren't going to screw it up. It was in their DNA to help. And that's what they did.
Absolutely. That's incredible. I'm not going to lie. I'm still slightly stuck on the Berlin Wall defecting story. This is what it means to study history. Listeners, it's the truth is stranger than fiction.
Well, I'll tell you this. So yeah. My first day in Gander, one of the first things I do is I call on the mayor because I want the mayor. The mayor is going to be an ally. He's going to introduce me to certain people, and I'm sitting in his office. He has me in his office. Big gregarious fellow. He just recently retired. He's been the mayor forever. And I'm sitting there, and we're making small talk. And I'm from Miami, like I said. Cuba and Fidel Castro is something that is very, very volatile here. I mean, I live in a community that has suffered because of Fidel Castro. There are people I know whose relatives were killed and imprisoned by Fidel Castro. And so this is not something that is lighthearted in any way. And so, I'm sitting in the mayor's office and I'm just sort of making chit chat. And I look it around and I go, and I'm saying, well, Mr. Mayor, I think this is very good. I think it's very interesting. And holy crap, is that a picture of you with Fidel Castro? And sure enough, sitting on his desk is a picture of him with Fidel. And he goes, oh yeah. And that's when he tells me the story about how Fidel comes by, would stop in and just sort of thing. And I went, and the mayor's attitude was, yeah, he just talks and talks and talks and talks and talks. And then he gets on the plane and then leaves. And, that's it. And I can tell you, I have covered here in Miami for decades, Cuban Americans who have plotted to assassinate Fidel Castro, who have attempted to kill Fidel Castro on the island, who have made every effort they can to kill Fidel Castro. And all I could think of sitting in the mayor's office that day was, holy crap. They keep trying to send hit squads to Latin American countries when he goes to a summit meeting or whack him when he's in Havana or somewhere in Cuba, the CIA trying to kill him in Havana. Who knew? The easiest place that probably he would have gotten him was kill him in Gander. Now, I don't imagine that a Cuban American hit squad, would blend into the folks of Gander. But it would have been interesting. And I just sort of scratched my head and I went, I cannot believe this. And he said, oh, yeah. And then that's how I learned that history. Anyway, I'm sorry. It was a bit of a tangent, but
I love tangents.
An idea.
Yeah, I love tangents. Normally get great stories in tangents. I do want to return to the generosity of the Ganderites. That's a topic I don't mind lingering on. And perhaps I'll introduce it this way because I want to confuse our listeners slightly at the beginning. What does the phrase, you can always add more water to the soup, mean to you?
Yeah. So that was going back to that notion of folks helping each other and the history of Newfoundland. Newfoundland founded in the 1600s, initially just as a series of fishing villages. You know, you would come over from England, from Ireland. You would fish for the season. You would catch as much as you could, and then you would return home. And you wouldn't stay year round. You would just get all that beautiful cod and whatever else was off the waters of Newfoundland. And over time, you know, people started to settle year round in Newfoundland. But it's a very hard place. It's called the Rock for a reason. That's the name that Newfoundlanders call the island. It's the Rock because it's a rock. And there's long been this custom to where if your neighbor is in trouble, if your neighbor's having a problem, you don't assume that somebody else or the government is going to help that neighbor. You go and you just show up and you say, I understand you're in trouble. How can I help? I'm here to help. And you know that if you're ever in trouble, your neighbors will come to you. And I'm talking about going back, you know, like 100, 150, 200 years, that spirit of we only can rely on each other. And there's an old adage that people used to say, especially because of the impoverished nature of Newfoundland, which is that, and you said it, you can always add a little bit more water to the soup. And the idea being that if I may not have a lot, I may just have a simple soup to feed my family. But if my neighbor is hungry and has nothing, I can invite them over to join me and add a little bit more water to the soup, and so that we can all have a warm meal. And I love that expression. I just use it all the time now. Mm. I try to think in those terms as well. You can always add a little bit more water to the soup. You can always provide for those who are less fortunate. You may not have much, but you can help those who have even less. And somehow you can all get through it together. And that spirit of helping one another came through. Again, that idea of we had Ganderites thinking that they had lost their focus, lost their purpose, you know, and suddenly the plain people arrived, almost 6,000-7,000 passengers. And coming together and forming those bonds so that while number of cities, Gander primarily, Appleton, Gambo, you know, took in plain people, even smaller towns on the periphery, when they heard what had happened, started forming cooking brigades. Mm. And they would share, families would, you know, wives and mothers would cook up stews or bake breads or bake pies. And then, you know, somebody would load it up into a truck or into a car and drive into Gander and just be told where can we drop these off? Oh, there's a bunch of people staying at the high school. And they would just go to the high school and load it up into the kitchen. And one of the things that is cherished in Newfoundland is the ability to moose hunt, to be able to hunt and kill. And it's not done for recreation. It's done for food. You know, if you get one of the prize permits to be able to kill an animal, you slaughter it and you freeze it. And that food can help you through a tough winter. There were families that went into their freezers to get some of this meat and make stews and deliver it to the folks who were stranded here. Nobody ever asked for any reimbursement. Nobody ever said, all right, how much can I get paid? And is there going to be a way for me to get a receipt for this? They just did what came naturally. And I will tell you, the passengers I spoke to, many of whom had taken trips to all over Europe, had eaten in some of the best restaurants in Europe, told me that the food that they got was some of the best food they'd ever eaten while they were away. They the stews, the breads, the soups, you know, everything was just, they just couldn't believe how generous people were. And that went for everything. You know, if you need, there were only a handful of pharmacies, like a couple of pharmacies in the town. If you think about it, you know, when you travel, you pack most of your medication in your bag, and maybe you take a day or so of pills on board with you. Well, nobody was allowed to get the suitcases from under the planes. They weren't offloading the planes. They had no idea how long people were going to be there. They didn't want to get into an issue of that. And so immediately, a number of passengers said, I need my blood pressure medication, or I need my heart medication, or I need this. And so the pharmacy just started working 24 hours a day, just filling the needs. People would pass by and say, I need, this is what I take, you know, I need a refill. And they were going, okay, they didn't ask, what's your insurance card? You know, who do I bill for this? They just started filling prescriptions. Doctors saw patients. Again, I run a healthcare system than we do, but nobody asked for any co-pays or anything like the Canadian Tire, which if you're not Canadian, you don't understand what Canadian Tire is. Canadian Tire is sort of like a cross between a Home Depot and a Kmart. You can get pretty much everything at a Canadian Tire. You can buy underwear at a Canadian Tire. You can also get a set of brand new tires. You can get ice skates. You can get everything. You know, you can get lawn furniture. Whatever you need, you can get at the Canadian Tire. The Canadian Tire in Gander just said, that's it. Whatever, if a passenger needs something, they can just take it off the shelf. Mm-hmm. There's no ringing it up. You know, like some of the, like there's two women didn't like the idea of sleeping in like one of the lodges because there were some snorers in there. There were people who were loud and it was noisy. And it was it was unseasonably warm during those days. It's normally cold, but it was beautiful in Gander during those days. And the women said, you know what, let's go down. And they walked down to the Canadian Tire and they started looking for camping equipment. They were going to set up a tent on the lawn outside of the lodge. And the manager for the Canadian Tire, they're loading up all their stuff, a lantern, sleeping bags, and the rest of it. And the manager says, oh, are you some of the plane people? Yeah. We were going to set up a little thing. And they said, okay, no problem. Well, how much do we? They tried to give him a credit card. They said, no, it's on us. Wow. And they sent one of the store clerks with them to help them set up the tent.
It's incredible.
That's the kind of generosity. I mentioned before about how some folks just opened up their homes, you know, so that if you didn't want to shower in the high school gym and wanted to, they started doing little carpools. You know, a person would show up and just sort of say, hey, you know, I've got a shower and a TV and some food in the fridge. If anybody want to come over to my house for a few hours, and hands would go up, person would load them in, take them to their house and sort of say, all right, there's towels in the closet. The TV's right there. There's food in the fridge. Go ahead, help yourself. And they would go, well, wait a second. Where are you going? I said, oh, I'm going to go to work, but you guys have the run of the place. You know, when you're done, just walk. It's three blocks and four blocks that way, and you're back to the place, or just spend the night. Well, I don't care. That's just the way it was. You know, two women were walking down a street and a woman came running out and said, are you the plane people? Are you the plane people? Yeah. I said, what are you doing? We just wanted to get a look around town. And she handed her car keys and said, go ahead, take my car. Take the car. Now, I talked to the woman later and I said, you just gave two strangers your car keys? And she said, where are they going to go? It's an island. It's not like you could drive off the island, you know? So they brought the car back in a day or so and everything was fine. That's the nature of Newfoundland.
It's incredible. Wow. So then I suppose moving on, did you know that it was going to be a book when you were covering the story, Jim?
Yeah, I was approaching it as if it was going to be a book. And so as I'm going through and thinking about characters, you know, as I'm talking to more and more people, there were really a handful of stories that I decided to focus on. The, you know, one story in particular was, you know, a young couple who were bringing back an adopted child from Kazakhstan, of all places, and just how watching them move through this, I'll never forget when the passengers came off the planes, the Canadian officials were brilliant because they put broken signs on every phone because they didn't want passengers grouped up at the phone.
Right.
And they removed every TV because they didn't want passengers standing in front of TV sets watching those horrific images of the plane going into the tower and the tower falling. I mean, I don't know what you did on 9/11. That's what I did. I just sat stupefied in front of my television watching for hours, just in pain at what I saw. So the Lopers, Roxanne and Clark Loper, they get off the plane They've got this brand new baby that they're taking with them, Alexandria, and they get eventually onto a school bus. And by the way, the school bus drivers in Gander were on strike on 9/11 in a dispute over wages. And the second that they heard that the planes were coming and that they needed the buses for transport, every school bus driver on strike laid down the picket signs and immediately went and said, no, no, this is different. We're here to help. When the Lopers finally got, after about, I think they were more than 12 hours on the ground before they were off the plane, because again, there's only one staircase for the plane. They're not that busy in an airport. And the Royal Canadian Mounted Police wanted to sort of check people as they were coming off to make sure that there wasn't any hidden threats. There was still a very real possibility. And the Red Cross in Canada was doing all of the organizing in terms of trying to figure out, all right, we got the manifest of this plane. We're going to send these people to this location, and was handling it. Very well organized, amazing disaster recovery. So by the time the Lopers reach the place where they, one of the lodges where they were sent, all they wanted to do was find a quiet room to get Alexandria to lay down. And they had set up a room for the parents with several small kids. I think they wanted to segregate them so that if there were crying babies, they wouldn't disturb everybody else.
Sure.
But, you know, so Clark and Roxanne settled into that room, were handed toothbrushes. There were piles of towels, piles of clean clothes that they wanted to change what they were wearing. And Roxanne told me about how once Alexandria was settled and while Clark stayed with her, she decided to get up and explore the lodge. And she went out to the main part of the building, and I'll never forget how she described this to me. It was a large room and there were people in it. And as she walked in the door, she could tell that there was a TV up and to her right. And everyone was just staring transfixed at the TV, and she didn't want to look. And so she just sort of walked slowly around the edge of the room with her head down till she got to the very back of the room, and then slowly lifted her head up and looked at the TV. And that's when she saw for the first time the towers coming down, because it was being played endlessly, obviously. And she just started crying. And most of the people in the room are crying. You know, it's interesting because so many of them didn't see it or fully understand it. They had been, you know, they'd gotten on cell phones, they had talked to relatives, but hearing it on the phone, it's not until you see it that you fully appreciate and understand it. And so when Roxanne saw it, she cried for a while, and then she went back to the room where Clark and Alexandria was, and she whispered to Clark that he should go look. And she stayed with Alexandria and held her new child tight. And Clark went and looked. And then Clark came back. And the two of them just in that moment thought to themselves, what kind of a world are we bringing this child into now? How is the world going to be different? And I've kept in touch with them over the years. I interviewed for the follow-up to the book. I did an updated version that came out last year. I spoke to Alexandria. He's now 21 years old. She has that. She doesn't obviously remember anything, but she knows the story. She understands it. And she's dedicated to giving back to people. You know, that sense of helping others, because she knows what it was like to be small and vulnerable and at risk and having others come to her aid. And she wants to do that for people now. And so she volunteers and she wants to be a teacher and all those sorts of things. So that's one of the stories I wanted to tell. And I use that as the spine throughout the entire piece from their journey from Kazakhstan until they finally, 6 days later, make it home to a small town outside of Dallas. The other story that I focused a lot on was the story of Hannah and Dennis O'Rourke. And Hannah and Dennis O'Rourke were living on Long Island. They were on vacation to Ireland. They're both Irish, as you can imagine, O'Rourke. And when they got to their destination and saw what had happened, their thoughts immediately went to their son, Kevin, a New York City firefighter. And Kevin worked in a fire company called Rescue 2, which is part of an elite rescue unit located just across the southern tip of Manhattan in Brooklyn. And Kevin and his team were one of the first to reach the towers. And she called her daughter, Hannah called her daughter, and they said that they had not heard from Kevin, but they sure he was okay because obviously he was just busy. Well, Kevin was missing. Kevin was in the building when it collapsed. And for the 5 days that they were there, they sat by the phone. The only time that Hannah left the phone was when she walked the three blocks to a small church to pray with the priest, and then would come right back. And when the folks in Gander discovered that the parents of a New York City firefighter, a missing New York City firefighter, was there, they, just like a handful of them, took them, just rallied around them, and never left their side during the entire time, including one woman who was 7 months pregnant and just sort of sat there with Hannah and Dennis. And they offered, there were numerous people who said, let's leave the lodge with all these people. Please come stay at my house. I won't even stay there. You can stay there alone. You can have privacy. And they were terrified to leave because they thought that the paperwork would show that they were there at the lodge and that they would somehow miss a phone call. So they never left that lodge. And the folks there did everything they could to try to ease their suffering, including there was one gentleman, Tom, I think his name was, who just told the worst jokes, just horrible, dumb jokes. I don't know how the jokes even made sense, but Hannah, being polite, would just sort of laugh. And there was another fellow who convinced her to just go and see the lake. Gander has a beautiful lake. Just take a half hour. Let's get out of here. Let's go to the lake. Your husband will sit by the phone, all the rest. And the young woman, and there was a woman named Beulah Cooper, who just a crazy old broad, and hit it off with Anna. And the two of them would just talk for hours as the days went by. And when I finished writing the book, and obviously you probably know the end of that story, Kevin's body is found a week after they returned to New York. He died. He was in the North Tower, still working his way up when the building came down. And when I finished writing the book and I tell their story at length, I got an advanced copy of the book and I brought it to them in Long Island, to the family in Long Island. I wanted to give them that. And I sat in Hannah and Dennis's living room with the rest of the family. And it was approaching the 1 year anniversary. And Hannah was particularly quiet and sullen, as you could imagine. And her daughter said, Mama, what was that guy who told you those jokes? And she goes, oh, Tom. And she smiled a little. And she said, what was that one joke she said? And he says, yeah, it was a drunk guy comes out of a bar and he bumps into a priest. And the drunk guy goes, hey, buddy, your collar's on backwards. And the priest goes, no, my collar's not on backwards. I'm a priest. I'm a father. And the drunk guy goes, well, that doesn't make any sense. If you're a father, then shouldn't your pants be on backwards? And she just starts laughing at the stupidity of it. It makes no sense. I do not understand that joke, but she smiled and she laughed at the memory of this awful joke. And then they said, well, what about that guy who took you to see the lake? Oh, yeah, he was a nice guy. They thought he was the taxi driver. It's funny. For years, they always thought, oh, that was the taxi driver. He wasn't a taxi driver. He was just a guy who was giving lifts to people around town, for the plane people. They need to go somewhere. So he thought he was the taxi driver. He wasn't. And then they would reminisce about Beulah. Oh, yeah, Beulah, she's crazy. Oh, yeah, Beulah's crazy. Yeah. And sitting there and seeing her smile and seeing her husband, Dennis, smile and the family have a small laugh, I realized that in the midst of all that pain and tragedy, all that darkness, that those days in Gander would have been for them, where there was nothing, nothing good, the folks in Gander were able to give them a few small good memories. It doesn't take away the hurt. It doesn't obliterate the pain, but it's just little pieces of light in what otherwise should be nothing but darkness. And that ability of the folks in Gander to do that for the O'Rourkes and for so many others who were scared and afraid and not knowing what was coming next, I think that was truly the real story of Gander. And it's not until I sat in that living room with them that I fully came to appreciate how important what they did in Gander was.
Wow. It's an amazing story, Jim. Thank you so much for sharing that. I know we're coming up on our time, Jim. One question I did want to ask you is, has there been a question about Gander that hasn't been asked of you that you wish someone would ask?
No, we've covered a lot with not just here, but in the past.
Sure.
I mean, it's just what I was saying. It's the small things. It's that notion of that it shouldn't take a tragedy for people to have that spirit. I ask this question of others, not about Gander, but about their own communities. Can you imagine if the roles were reversed? Can you imagine that something like this happened in your town, where a group of strangers suddenly found themselves unmoored, uncertain, unsure? What would you do in that moment? Most of us, I think, would think to ourselves, well, that's what government is for. That's what, you know, let the city, state, or federal government handle that. Or that's the Red Cross. Let the Red Cross handle that. I'll give a $5 or $10 or $50 donation later. Yeah. But maybe we should be thinking more about what we can do, how we can sort of make things better for those around us in good times and in bad. So it's not so much about Gander as it is about ourselves. I guess the thing that I worry sometimes is that Gander seems like such a unicorn in the world that people can write it off and say, well, that's unique to them. But should it be? Should it be unique to them? Or is that something that we should think about more for ourselves? That's the way I sort of look at it.
Well said. It's a good thought, I think, leave with, Jim. Jim DeFede, how can people find out about you, sir?
You don't really have to. I mean, I work at CBS. You can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @DeFede, D-E-F-E-D-E. Like I said, I work at CBS. I do a lot of stories on tragedies. I've been covering the Surfside building collapse that took 98 lives. And even in the midst of that, finding stories that offer some sort of hope and some sense of humanity, because that's the thing that I tend to look for is that in the midst of the worst of us, where does the best of us also come?
Excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time for me, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joshua.
All right. You take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.